The whole Kepler epiphyte sempermarine thing is stressful enough all by itself, and the last thing he needs is to be hanging around with people who believe it is nothing more than a skirmish in a war to decide the fate of the free world. A preliminary round of the apocalypse. Avi's obsession with the Holocaust seemed fine to Randy as long as Holocausts were things that happened long ago or far away. Being personally involved in one is something Randy can do without. He should have stayed in Seattle. But he didn't, and so the next best thing for him is to limit the conversation to straightforward things like bars of gold.
In order for him to have a claim, the dentist needs to prove that Sempermarine found that wreck when it was doing the cable survey, right?
Doug asks.
Right,
Cantrell says, before Randy can step in and say that it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, I have been kicking around this part of the world for half of my life, and I can always testify that I found the wreck on an earlier survey. That son of a bitch can never prove that I'm lying,
Doug says. Andrew Loeb, his lawyer, is smart enough to know that. He will not put you on the stand, Randy says, screwing his own hard drive into place.
Fine. Then all he's got is circumstantial evidence. Namely, the proximity of the wreck to the cable survey corridor.
Right, which implies a correlation,
Cantrell says.
Well, it's not that damn close,
Doug says.
I was cutting a very wide swath at the time.
I have bad news, Randy says. First of all, it is a civil case, and so circumstantial evidence is all he needs to win. Secondly, I just heard from Avi on the plane that Andrew Loeb is filing a second suit for breach of contract.
What goddamn contract?
Doug demands. He has anticipated everything you just said, Randy says. He still doesn't know where the wreck is, but if it turns out to be miles and miles away from the survey corridor, he will claim that by surveying such a wide swath, you are basically risking the dentist's money in order to go prospecting. And that, thus, the dentist still deserves a share of the proceeds.
Why does the dentist want to beef with me?
Doug says. Because then he can pressure you into testifying against Epiphyte. You get to keep all the gold. That gold becomes damages which the dentist leverages into control of Epiphyte.
Jesus fucking Christ!
Doug exclaims.
He can kiss my ass.
I know that, Randy says. But if he gets wind of that attitude, he'll just come up with another tactic and file another suit. Doug begins,
Well, that's kind of defeatist.
Where I'm headed with this, Randy says, is that we cannot fight the dentist on his turf, which is the courtroom, any more than the Viet Cong could have fought a pitched battle in the open against the U.S. Army. So there are some really good reasons to get that gold out of the wreck surreptitiously before the dentist can prove it's there. Doug looks outraged.
Randy, have you ever tried to swim while holding a gold bar in one hand?
There's got to be a way to do it. Little submarines or something. Doug laughs out loud and mercifully decides not to debunk the concept of little submarines.
Supposing it was possible, what do I do with the gold then? If I deposit it in a bank account or spend it on something, what's to keep this Andrew Loeb guy from taking that as circumstantial evidence that the wreck had a ton of money in it? You're saying I have to sit on this money for the rest of my life in order to protect you from this lawsuit.
Doug, you can do this, Randy says. You get the gold. You put it on a boat. My friends here can explain the rest. Randy fits the laptop's plastic case back together and begins maneuvering the little screws back into their recesses. Cantrell says,
You bring the boat here.
Tom continues,
To that beach, right down the hill. I'll be waiting for you with the Humvee.
And you and Tom can drive it downtown and deposit that bullion in the vaults of the Central Bank of Kinnekuda,
Cantrell concludes. Someone has finally said something that actually knocked Doug Shafto off balance.
And get what in return?
He asks suspiciously.
Electronic cash from the crypt. Anonymous, untraceable, and untaxable.
Doug's regained his composure now and is back to belly laughs.
What'll that buy me? Pictures of naked girls on the World Wide Web?
Soon enough, he'll buy you anything that money can buy,
Tom says.
I would have to know a little more about it,
Doug says.
but once again we are straying from the agenda. Let's leave it at this. You guys need me to strip that wreck bare, quickly and secretly.
It's not just what we need. It might be in your best interests, too, Randy says, groping on the back of the laptop for the power switch.
Item the second. A former NSA Hondo is surveilling us, and something about a wizard?
John says. Yeah.
Doug's giving Randy a queer look, and so Randy launches into a brief summary of his classification system of wizards, elves, dwarves, and men, not to mention golems, which makes practically no sense to Doug, who hasn't read Lord of the Rings. Randy goes on to tell them about his conversation with Pontifex on the airplane phone. John Cantrell and Tom Howard are interested in this, as Randy would expect them to be, but what surprises him is how intently Doug Shafto listens.
Randy,
Doug almost shouts.
Didn't you at any point ask this guy why old man Comstock was so interested in the Arethusa messages?
Coincidentally, this is the third item on the agenda, Cantrell says.
Why didn't you ask him on the ski lift? Randy jokes.
I was giving him a very closely reasoned explanation of why I was about to sever the linkage between his ugly and perfumed corporeal self and his eternally condemned soul,
Doug says.
Seriously, you got the messages from your grandpa's old war souvenirs, right?
Right.
And your grandpa Waterhouse picked them up where?
Judging from the dates, he must have been in Manila.
Well, what do you imagine could have happened in Manila around that time that would be so damned important to Earl Comstock?
I told you. Comstock thought it was a communist code.
But that's bullshit,
Doug says.
Jesus, haven't you guys spent any time at all around people like Comstock? Can't you recognize bullshit? Don't you think it would be a useful item to add to your intellectual toolkits to be capable of saying when a ton of wet, steaming bullshit lands on your head, my goodness, this appears to be bullshit? Now, what do you think is the real reason Comstock wanted to crack Arethusa?
I have no idea, Randy says.
The reason is gold,
Doug says. Randy snorts. Oh, you've got gold on the brain.
Did I or did I not take you out into the jungle and show you something?
Doug demands.
You did, sorry.
Gold is the only thing that could account for it. Because otherwise the Philippines just were not that important during the 50s to justify such an effort at the NSA.
There was an ongoing hook insurrection, Tom says. But you're right. The real focus, around here anyway, was Vietnam.
You know something?
Fires back Doug.
During the Vietnam War, which was old man Comstock's brainchild, the American military presence in the Philippines was huge. That son of a bitch had soldiers and Marines crawling over Luzon, supposedly on training missions. But I think they were looking for something. I think they were looking for the primary.
As in primary gold repository?
You got it.
Is that what Marcos eventually found?
Opinions differ,
Doug says.
A lot of people think that the primary is still waiting to be discovered.
Well, there isn't any information about the primary or anything else in these messages, Randy says.
The laptop has booted up now, in Unix mode, with a torrent of error messages, triggered by his inability to find various pieces of hardware that were present on Randy's laptop, which is in a Ford dealership's dumpster in Los Altos, but are not on Tom's. And yet, the basic kernel works to the point that Randy can look in the file system and make sure it's intact. The Arethusa directory is still there with its long list of short files, each file the result of running a different stack of cards through Chester's card reader. Randy opens up the first one and finds several lines of random capital letters.
How do you know there's no information about the primary in those messages, Randy?
Doug asks. The NSA couldn't decrypt these messages in 10 years, Randy says. It all turned out to be a hoax, the output of a random number generator. Randy jumps back out to the file listing and types grep, uppercase AADAA, asterisk, and hits the return key. It is a command to find the opening letter group in the ETC card messages, the famous one to which Pontifex had alluded. The machine answers back almost immediately with an empty prompt, meaning that the search failed.
Holy shit, Randy says.
What? everyone says at once. Randy takes a long, deep breath.
These are not the same messages that Earl Comstock spent 10 years attempting to break.
Deluge. It takes Goto Dango about half a minute to waddle up the narrow entrance of the tunnel. He is trailing the fingers of one hand along the stone ceiling just above his head, feeling the scars of the drills. Behind him, he can hear the four members of his crew making their way along, muttering to each other calmly. His fingers slide over a lip and rise up into empty dark space. He's into the main drift now. He stands up and wades forward. Perfect blackness is cozy and reassuring to him. In it, he can always pretend that he is still a boy, back on Hokkaido. He can make believe that the last few years of his life have never happened. But in fact, he is a grown-up, and he is trapped in a hole in the Philippines and surrounded by armies of demons. He opens the valves on an acetylene headlamp and sparks it into life. He is perfectly capable, by this point, of finding his way around Golgotha in the dark, but his crew is not, and he leaves them far behind. He stubs his toe brutally on a large gold bar that has carelessly been left lying across the iron railway and curses.
"Is everything okay, Lieutenant?"
says one of his crew, 50 meters behind him.
"Fine,"
Goto Dango says, loudly and clearly.
"You four, be careful you do not break your toes on this bar."
So now, Wing and Rodolfo and their men, waiting up ahead, know the number of Nipponese soldiers they have to kill.
"Where are the last few workers?"
one of the crew shouts.
"In the fool's vault."
It takes them several minutes to pick their way through the main vault, because it is packed with treasure. The starry core of a galaxy must look like this. They clamber up the shaft in its ceiling and make their way to the Hall of Glory. Goto Dango finds the bare wires that lead to the electric light bulb and attaches them to the screw terminals on a battery. Running at the wrong voltage, the bulb looks like a tangerine floating in ink.
"Shut off your headlamps,"
Goto Dango says,
"to conserve fuel. I will leave mine burning in case there is an interruption in the power."
He pulls a fistful of white cotton from a sterile box. It is the cleanest, whitest thing he has seen in several years. He pulls it apart into smaller wads like Father Ferdinand, breaking the bread of the Mass, and passes them out to the men who stuff it ritualistically into their ears.
"There is no more time to waste,"
he hollers.
"Captain Noda must be growing impatient out there."
"Sir,"
one of the men says, standing at attention and handing him a pair of wires marked Main Tunnel Demolition.
"Very well,"
Goto Dango says, and screws the wires down to a pair of terminals on a wooden switchbox. It seems as though he should say something ceremonious, but nothing comes to mind. Nipponese men are dying all over the Pacific without first getting to make speeches. He clenches his teeth together, shuts his eyes, and twists the switch handle. The shock wave comes through the floor first, whacking the soles of their feet like a flying plank. A moment later, it comes through the air and strikes them like a moving wall of stone. The cotton in the ears seems to accomplish nothing. Goto Dango feels his eyes bounce off the backs of their sockets. All of his teeth feel as though they have been crisply sheared off at the gum line with cold chisels. The wind is all forced out of his lungs. They are empty for the first time since the moment of his birth. Like newborn infants, he and the other men can only writhe and look around themselves in a panic until their bodies learn how to draw breath again. One of the men brought a bottle of sake, which is shattered. They pass around the jagged bottom of the bottle, each man taking a gulp of what remains. Goto Dango tries to pull the cotton out of his ears and finds that the shock wave drove it in so deep that it cannot be extracted. So he merely shouts,
"Check your watches!"
They all do.
"In 2 hours, Captain Noda will demolish the plug on the bottom of the lake and flood the water traps. In the meantime, we have work to do. You all know your jobs. Get to work."
They all hi, turn on their heels, and go their separate ways. It is the first time that Goto Dengo has actually sent men off to their deaths. But they are all dead men anyway, and so he doesn't know how to feel about it. If he still believed in the Emperor, still believed in the war, he would think nothing of it. But if he still believed, he wouldn't be doing what he is about to do. It is important to keep up the appearance that this is a normal operation, and so he descends to the vault to perform his next scheduled duty, inspect what used to be the main drift. The vault is filled with a fog of rock dust around which his windpipe clenches like a fist grabbing a rope. His acetylene lamp only makes the dust glow, giving him a visibility of perhaps 6 inches. All he can see is the bullion right in front of his face, which still glimmers beneath a film of dust and smoke. The shockwave has deranged his formerly neat stacks of crates and bricks and turned the entire hoard into a rude mound that is still shedding avalanches, seeking its angle of repose. A 75-kilogram gold brick slides down the pile like a runaway boxcar, emerging suddenly from the cloud of dust, and he jumps out of its way. Bits of rock are still sifting down from the crazed ceiling and plinking against his helmet. He scrambles carefully over the heap, breathing through a wad of cotton, until he can see what used to be the main drift. The dynamite has done the right thing, shattered the roof of the drift into billions of shards. Collapsed on the floor, they occupy a larger volume than the same mass of stone did when it was all in one piece. The drift is filled with tons of loose stone, all the way down to the entrance along the Tojo River, where Captain Noda's men are at work even now, concealing the tiny puncture wound behind river rocks. He feels, rather than hears, a small explosion and knows that something is going wrong. No one should be setting off explosions now. Movement in this place is agonizingly slow, like a nightmare when you are trying to run away from a demon. It takes him so long to get back to the Hall of Glory that there is almost no point in doing it. Whatever was happening is over when he arrives. What he sees when he arrives is a group of 3 men waiting for him. Wing, Rodolfo, and the Filipino named Bong.
The soldiers?
All dead, Rodolfo says flatly, irritated by the stupidity of the question.
The others?
One soldier set off a grenade, killed himself and my 2 men, Wing says.
Another soldier heard the grenade and had a knife ready when Augustine came for him,
Bong says. He shakes his head sorrowfully.
I think that Augustine was not ready to kill a man. He hesitated.
Goto Dengo stares at Bong, fascinated.
And you?
Bong doesn't understand the question for a moment. Then light dawns.
Oh no, I did not hesitate, Lieutenant Goto. A Nipponese soldier hurt my sister one time in a very inappropriate way.
Goto Dengo stands there silently for a while, until he notices that the other men are all looking at him expectantly. Then he checks his watch. He is shocked to see that only half an hour has gone by since he set off the dynamite.
We have an hour and a half before the water traps are flooded. If we are not in the bubble by then, we will be sealed off with no escape possible,
says Goto Dengo.
We go there and wait,
Wing suggests in Shanghainese.
No. Captain Noda listens outside for more explosions,
Goto Dengo says, also in Chinese. Then, in English, tells the Filipinos,
We have to set off the demolition charges at certain times, or Noda-san will grow suspicious.
Whoever sets them off will be trapped forever in this chamber,
Rodolfo says, gesturing around them at the Hall of Glory.
We will not set them off from here,
says Goto Dengo, pulling the lid from a crate. Inside are several long coils of 2-stranded telephone wire. He hands the coils out to Rodolfo, Wing, and Bong. They understand and begin to splice the new wires onto the ones that terminate here. They retreat through Golgotha in stages, lugging battery packs with them and unrolling the wires as they go, dynamiting the tunnel sections behind them one by one. As they do this, certain oddities of the tunnel system finally become clear to Rodolfo, Wing, and Bong. it becomes fully evident to them for the first time that the entire complex was carefully designed by Gotodango to serve two entirely contradictory purposes. To a loyal Nipponese engineer like Captain Noda, it looks like precisely what he was ordered to build, a vault laced with booby traps. But to the four men sealed inside, Golgotha has a second function. It is an escape machine. As the purposes of certain rooms, drifts, and other features suddenly become clear, they straighten up, blinking, and turn to look at Gotodango with the same expressions as the soldiers wore weeks ago when they discovered the Buddha in the Mercedes. Their destination is the bubble, a niche that Gotodango had them carve out of the stone during the last couple of months. He claimed, to anyone who asked, that it was a water reservoir, put there to increase the deadlines of one of the traps. It is a wide vertical shaft, 4 meters in diameter, that begins in the ceiling of a peripheral drift and goes straight up for a few meters, then dead ends. Ladders still cling to its walls, and by ascending, they can reach a rock ledge big enough to sit on. Canteens of water and boxes of biscuits have already been stocked here by Wing and his men. By the time they reach their seats in the top of the bubble, all of the others are in awe of Gotodango and ready to do whatever he says. He senses this. It fills him with unutterable misery. They have 15 minutes to wait. The others spend it sipping water and nibbling biscuits. Gotodango fills it with self-recrimination.
"I am a loathsome worm," he says. "A traitor, a filthy piece of dog shit. Not worthy to clean out the latrines of true soldiers of Nippon. I am bereft, totally cut off from the nation I've betrayed. I am now part of a world of people who hate Nippon and who therefore hate me, but at the same time I am hateful to my own kind. I will stay here and die."
"You are alive," Rodolfo says. "You have saved our lives, and you are rich."
"Rich?"
Wing and Rodolfo and Bong look at each other, confused.
"Yes, of course,"
Bong says. Gotodango is still looking nonplussed. Reckoning that he has merely gone deaf or daft from the explosions, Bong reaches into his trousers and pulls out a hand-sewn pouch, teases it open, and displays a healthy double handful of diamonds. Wing and Rodolfo scarcely take note. Gotodango looks away despondently. He himself has saved no treasure, except these men's lives. But that's not why he feels so bad. He had hoped that being thus saved, they would all be noble, and not think of the treasure. But maybe that was too much to hope for. A distant thump lifts them slightly off the ledge, just for a moment. Gotodango feels a strange sensation in his head. The air pressure is beginning to rise. The column of air trapped in the diagonal is being compressed by a piston of water rushing down it from the lake. Captain Noda has dynamited the plug. Gotodango is so excited that he forgets to die. He is an engineer, trapped inside one of his own machines. The machine was designed to keep him alive, and he will never know whether it worked unless it works. After he has achieved that satisfaction, he supposes, he can always kill himself at leisure. He pinches his nose shut, presses his lips together, and begins to blow air into his eustachian tubes, equalizing the pressure. The others follow his lead. All of Golgotha's traps are basically the same. All of them derive their killing power from the pressure of the water communicated down to this level from the bottom of Lake Yamamoto. In any number of places in the complex, false walls have been constructed, designed to be pierced by greedy thieves, or to collapse of their own accord when thieves dig out the sand that holds them up. Then the water will rush in with explosive force and probably crush them before they have a chance to drown. At its Golgotha end, the diagonal tunnel forks again and again, like a river breaking up into distributaries. Gotodango explained it to inspecting officers by likening it to the plumbing inside a modern hotel, which is supplied by a single main that is pressurized by a distant water tower, but which divides into many different pipes that supply pressurized water to taps all over the structure. Golgotha seethes, hisses and moans as every pipe in its ramified system is pressurized by the deluge unleashed by Captain Noda's dynamite charge. The bubbles of air trapped at the ends of those pipes are seeking escape. Some are leaking out through cracks in the walls, and others are bubbling away into the diagonal. The surface of Lake Yamamoto must be boiling like a cauldron, and Captain Noda must be standing above it, watching the air flee Golgotha, grinning with satisfaction. In moments, the floors of the tunnels are obscured by whirling lagoons of dirty water, and the barrels and rail cars that were left there have begun to rise, bobbing like corks and clanging together. Most of the air trapped in the Golgotha does not, however, come bubbling up out of Lake Yamamoto. Most of it rises towards the bubble, because that is how Goto Dengo planned it. He knows it's working because his ears begin to pop. Eventually the water rises up into the bubble itself, but it rises slowly because the pressure of the air in here has become quite high already. As the water climbs, it further pressurizes the bubble of air in which Goto Dengo and the others are trapped. The pressure of the air rises steadily until it becomes equal to the pressure of the water. Then balance is achieved, and the water cannot rise anymore. Another kind of balance is being reached within their bodies as the compressed air floods into their chests, and the nitrogen in that air seeps through the membranes of their lungs and dissolves into their bloodstreams.
"Now we wait," says Goto Dengo,
and shuts off his acetylene lamp, leaving them in darkness.
"As long as we do not burn lamps, there is enough air in this chamber to keep us alive for several days. Captain Noda and his men will spend at least that long tidying up the boondock site, erasing all traces of our work and killing themselves. So we must wait, or else his men will only kill us when we appear on the shores of Lake Yamamoto. I would like to spend the time educating you on the subject of caisson disease, also known as the bends."
2 days later, they set off one last relatively small dynamite charge, blowing a hole through the wall of the bubble that is large enough to admit a human being. On the other side, the diagonal to Lake Yamamoto begins. Rodolfo is more terrified than anyone else, and so they send him first. Then goes Bong, and then Wing. Finally, Goto Dengo leaves the foul, used-up air of the bubble behind. Within a few moments, they have found their way into the ascending diagonal tunnel. They begin to swim uphill through total darkness. All of them are trailing their hands against the tunnel ceiling, feeling for the opening of the first vertical shaft. Rodolfo is supposed to stop when he feels it, but the others must also be alert in case Rodolfo misses. They thud into one another in the darkness like a loosely connected train bumping to a halt. Rodolfo has stopped. With any luck, he has found the first vertical shaft. Wing finally moves forward, and Goto Dengo follows straight up the vertical shaft and finally into a bulb at its top, where a bubble of air has been trapped. The bulb is just barely wide enough to accommodate four men. They pause there, all jammed together in a cluster of bodies, heaving as they exhale the nitrogen and carbon dioxide-tainted air that they've been living on for the last 60 seconds, and breathe in fresh lungfuls. Goto Dengo feels his ears popping as pressure is relieved. They have covered only a small fraction of the 450 meters that separate Golgotha from the lake horizontally, but half of the 100-meter vertical distance has already been covered. That is, the pressure of the air they are breathing in this chamber is only half of what it was in the bubble. Goto Dengo is not a diver and knows very little of diving medicine, but his father used to speak of how caissons were used to send workers deep underwater to build things or to mine. That is how he learned about caisson disease and how he learned the rule of thumb that most men will not suffer its symptoms if you have them decompress for a while at half the original air pressure. If they stop and breathe for a while, the nitrogen will come out of the tissues. Once this is done, the air pressure may be halved again. In the bubble, the air pressure was 9 or 10 atmospheres. Here in the first chamber, it's more like 5. But there's not much air in this one, just enough to let them breathe for 15 or 20 minutes and bleed nitrogen out of their tissues and get lungfuls of air for the next leg of the swim.
"Okay,"
Goto Dango says.
We go.
He finds Rodolfo in the darkness and slaps him encouragingly on the shoulder. Rodolfo takes a series of deep breaths, getting ready, and Goto Dango recites the numbers that they all know by heart.
25 strokes straight, then the tunnel bends up. 40 strokes up a steep hill. Where the tunnel bends again, you go straight up to the next air chamber.
Rodolfo nods, crosses himself, and then does a somersault in the water and kicks himself downwards. Then goes Bong, then Wing, and finally Goto Dango. This leg is very long. The last 15 meters is a vertical ascent into the air chamber. Goto Dango had hoped that the natural buoyancy of their bodies would make this easy, even if they were on the verge of drowning. But as he is kicking up the narrow shaft, pushing frantically on the feet of Wing, who is above him and not going as fast as he would like, he feels a growing panic in his lungs. Finally, he understands that he must fight the urge to hold his breath, that his lungs are filled with air at a much higher pressure than the water around him, and that if he doesn't let some of that air out, his chest will explode. So against his instinct to save that precious air, he lets it boil out of his mouth. He hopes that the bubbles will pass by the faces of the men above him and give them the idea too, but shortly after he does it, they all stop moving entirely. For perhaps 10 seconds, Goto Dango is trapped in total darkness in a water-filled vertical hole in the rock that is not much wider than his own body. Of all the things he has experienced in the war, this is the worst. But just as he gives up and prepares to die, they begin moving again. They are half dead when they get to the breathing chamber. If Goto Dango's calculations were right, then the pressure in here should be no more than 2 or 3 atmospheres. But he is beginning to doubt those calculations. When he has breathed in enough air to restore full consciousness, he's aware of sharp pains in his knees, and it's clear from the sounds that the others are making that they are suffering the same way.
This time, we wait as long as we can, he says.
The next leg is shorter, but it's made more difficult by the pain in their knees. Again, Rodolfo goes first. But when Goto Dango rises into the next air chamber, about 1.5 atmospheres above normal, only Bong and Wing are there.
Rodolfo missed the opening, Bong says. I think he went too far, up the ventilation shaft.
Goto Dango nods. Only a few meters beyond where they turned into this passage is a ventilation shaft that goes all the way to the surface. It has a sharp sideways jog in the middle that Goto put there so that when Captain Noda filled it up with rubble, which he has presumably done by now, the diagonal tunnel, their escape route, would not be blocked. If Rodolfo went up that shaft, he found a cul-de-sac with no air bubble in the top. Goto Dango doesn't have to tell the others that Rodolfo is dead. Bong crosses himself and says a prayer. Then they stay for a while and take advantage of the air that Rodolfo should be sharing. The pain in Goto Dango's knees becomes sharper, but after a while it plateaus.
From here, only small changes in altitude, not much need to decompress. Mostly we swim for distance now, he says.
They still have more than 300 horizontal meters to cover, pierced with 4 more shafts for air. The last of these doubles as a legitimate ventilation shaft. So from there on, it is just swimming and resting, until finally the walls of the tunnel peel away from them, and they find themselves in Lake Yamamoto. Goto Dango breaks the surface and does nothing for a long time but tread water and breathe clean air. It is nighttime, and for the first time in a year, Boondock is quiet, except for the sound of Bong, kneeling on the shore of the lake, making the sign of the cross and mumbling prayers as fast as his lips can move. Wing has already departed, without so much as a goodbye. This is shocking to Goto Dango, until he realizes what it means. He, too, is free to go. As far as the world knows, he is dead. All of his obligations discharged. for the first time in his life, he can do whatever he wants. He swims to the shore, gets up on his feet, and starts walking. His knees hurt. He cannot believe that he has come through all of this, and his only problem is sore knees. Bust.
Copy,
Randy says to the flight attendant, then reconsiders, remembering that he is in steerage this time and getting to a toilet might not be so easy. It's just a little Malaysian Air 757. The flight attendant sees the indecision on his face and wavers. Her face is framed in a gaudy, vaguely Islamic scarf that is the most tokenistic nod to sexual modesty he has ever seen.
Kopi nya kafina,
Randy says, and she beams and pours from the orange carafe. It is not that she doesn't speak English, just that Randy is starting to feel comfortable with the local pigeon. He realizes that this is the first step in a long process that will eventually turn him into one of these cheerful, burly, sunburned expats who infest the airport bars and Shangri-La hotels of the Rim. Outside his window, the long, slender Isle of Palawan lies parallel to their flight path. A fog-bound pilot could almost get from Kinakuta to Manila by following Palawan's beaches, but that is a moot point on a day like this. Those beaches slope gradually into the transparent waters of the South China Sea. When you're down there, planted in the sand, looking at a glancing angle across the waves, it probably doesn't look like much. But from up here you can see straight down through the water for many fathoms, and so all of the islands, even the coral heads, have skirts that start out dark brown or dun near the water and blend into yellow and finally into swimming pool blue before eventually fading into the deep blue of the ocean. Every little coral head and sandbar looks like the iridescent eye on a peacock's plume. After the conversation at Tom Howard's last night, Randy slept in his guest room and then spent most of the day in Kinakuta buying a new laptop, complete with a new hard drive, and transferring all of the data from the drive he salvaged in Los Altos onto the new one, encrypting everything in the process. Considering all of the completely boring and useless corporate documents he is subjected to state-of-the-art encryption, he can't believe he carried the Arethusa stuff around on his hard drive unencrypted for several days and across a couple of national borders. Not to mention the original ETC punch cards, which now reside in Tom Howard's basement safe. Of course, that stuff is encrypted to begin with, but that was done in 1945, and so by modern standards it might as well have been enciphered with a cereal box decoder ring. Or at least, that is what Randy is kind of hoping. Another thing he did this morning was to download the current version of the Cryptonomicon from the FTP server where it lives in San Francisco. Randy's never looked at it in detail, but he has heard it contains samples of code, or at least algorithms, that he could use to attack Arethusa. With luck, the very latest public code-breaking techniques in the Cryptonomicon might match up to the classified technology that Pontifex and his colleagues were employing at the NSA 30 years ago. Those techniques didn't work against the Arethusa messages that they were trying to decrypt, but this was probably only because those messages were random numbers, not the real messages. Now that Randy has what he suspects are the real messages, he may be able to accomplish what Earl Comstock tried and failed to do during the 50s. They are angling across the Terminator, not the robotic assassin of moviedom, but the line between night and day, through which our planet incessantly rotates. Looking east, Randy can see over the rim of the world to places where it is dusk, and the clouds catch only the reddest fraction of the sun's light, squatting in darkness but glowing with sullen contained fire, like coals in their feathery ruffs of ash. The airplane is still in the daylight, and is assiduously tracked by mysterious bars of rainbow, like spectral doppelgangers, probably some new NSA surveillance technology. Some of the Palawan's rivers run blue and straight into the ocean, and some carry enormous plumes of eroded silt that feather out into the ocean and are swept up the shore by currents. In Kinakuta, there is less deforestation than there is here, but only because they have oil instead. All of these countries are burning resources at a fantastic rate to get their economies stoked up, gambling that they'll be able to make the jump into hyperspace, some kind of knowledge economy, presumably, before they run out of stuff to sell and turn into Haiti. Randy is paging his way through the opening sections of the Cryptonomicon, but he can never concentrate when he's on an airplane. The opening sections are stolen pages from World War II-era military manuals. These used to be classified until 10 years ago when one of Cantrell's friends found copies just sitting in a library in Kentucky and drove there with a shitload of dimes and photocopied them. That got public civilian cryptanalysis up to where the government was in the 1940s. The Xeroxes have been scanned and OCR'd and converted to the HTML format used for web pages so that people can put in links and marginal notes and annotations and corrections without messing with the original text. And this they have done enthusiastically, which is all very well, but makes it hard to read. The original text is set in a deliberately crabbed, old-fashioned typeface to make it instantly distinguishable from the cyber-era annotations. The introduction to the Cryptonomicon was written, probably before Pearl Harbor, by a guy named William Friedman, and is filled with aphorisms probably intended to keep neophyte codebreakers from slapping grenades to their heads after a long week of wrestling with the latest Nipponese machine ciphers. The fact that the scientific investigator works 50% of his time by non-rational means is, it seems, quite insufficiently recognized. Intuition, like a flash of lightning, lasts only for a second. It generally comes when one is tormented by a difficult decipherment, and when one reviews in his mind the fruitless experiments already tried. Suddenly the light breaks through and one finds, after a few minutes, what previous days of labor were unable to reveal. And, Randy's favorite, as to luck, there is the old miner's proverb, gold is where you find it. So far, so good. Then, with a few whacks of the page-down key, Randy's looking at endless staggered grids of random letters, some kind of pre-digital method for solving ciphers, which the author would not have put into the document if they did not convey some kind of useful lesson to the reader. Randy is miserably aware that until he has learned to read through these grids, he will not even be up to the level of competence of a World War II novice cryptanalyst. The sample messages used are like, "One plane reported lost at sea," and "Troops having difficulty maintaining connection with 45th Infantry, stop," which Randy finds kind of hokey until he remembers that the book was written by people who probably didn't know what hokey meant, who lived in some radically different pre-hokiness era where planes really did get lost at sea, and the people in those planes never came back to see their families, and in which people who even raised the issue of hokiness in conversation were likely to end up pitied or shunned or maybe even psychoanalyzed. Randy feels like a little shit when he thinks about this stuff. He wonders about Chester. Is the shattered 747 hanging from Chester's ceiling just a monumental act of bad taste, or is Chester actually making a statement with that thing? Could it be that nerdy Chester is actually some kind of deep thinker who has transcended the glibness and superficiality of his age? This very subject has been debated by serious people at some length, which is why learned articles about Chester's house keep showing up in unexpected places. Randy wonders if he's ever had a serious experience in his life, an experience that would be worth the time it would take to reduce it to a pithy stop-punctuated message in capital letters and run it through a crypto system. They must have flown right by the site of the wreck. In a few days, Randy will turn right around and come halfway back to Kinakuta to make what meager contribution he can to the job of dragging gold bars out of it. He's only going to Manila to take care of some business there, some kind of urgent meeting demanded by one of Epiphyte's Filipino partners. The stuff that Randy came to Manila to do a year and a half ago mostly runs itself now, and when it actually requires his attention, he finds it fantastically annoying. He can see that the modern way of thinking about stuff, as applied to the Cryptonomicon, isn't going to help him very much in his goal of decrypting the Arethusa intercepts. The original writers of the Cryptonomicon actually had to decrypt and read these goddamn messages in order to save the lives of their countrymen, but the modern annotators have no interest in reading other people's mail, per se. The only reason they pay attention to this subject at all is that they aspire to make new cryptosystems that cannot be broken by the NSA, or now this new IDTRO thing. The Black Chamber. Crypto experts won't trust a cryptosystem until they have attacked it, and they can't attack it until they know the basic cryptanalytical techniques, and hence the demand for a document like this modern annotated version of the Cryptonomicon. But their attacks generally don't go any further than demonstrating a system's vulnerabilities in the abstract. All they want is to be able to say, in theory, this system could be attacked in the following way, because from a formal number theory standpoint, it belongs to such and such class of problems, and those problems, as a group, take about so many processor cycles to attack. And this all fits very well with the modern way of thinking about stuff in which all you need to do in order to attain a sense of personal accomplishment and earn the accolades of your peers is to demonstrate an ability to slot new examples of things into the proper intellectual pigeonholes. But the gap between demonstrating the vulnerability of a cryptosystem in the abstract and actually breaking a bunch of messages written in that cryptosystem is as wide and as profound as the gap between being able to criticize a film, for example, by slotting it into a particular genre or movement, and being able to go out into the world with a movie camera and a bunch of unexposed film and actually make one. Of these issues, the Cryptonomicon has nothing to say until you tunnel down to its oldest and deepest strata, some of which, Randy suspects, were written by his grandfather. The head flight attendant comes in on the intercom and says something in various languages. Each transition to a new language is accompanied by a sort of frisson of confusion running through the whole passenger compartment. First, the English-speaking passengers all ask each other what the English version of the announcement said, and just as they are giving it up as a lost cause, the Cantonese version winds down and the Chinese-speaking passengers ask each other what it said. The Malay version gets no reaction at all because no one actually speaks the Malay language, except maybe for Randy when he is asking for coffee. Presumably, the message has something to do with the fact that the plane is about to land. Manila sprawls up below them in the dark, vast patches of it flickering on and off as different segments of the electrical power grid struggle with their own particular challenges vis-a-vis maintenance and overload. In his mind, Randy is already sitting in front of his TV, tucking into a bowl of Cap'n Crunch. Maybe there is a place in Naya where he can purchase a brick of ice-cold milk so that he will not even have to stop at a 24 jam on the way home. The Malaysian air flight attendants all have big smiles for him on the way out. As globe-trotting expat technocrats all know, hospitality industry people think it is just adorable, or pretend to think so, when you try to use some language, any language, other than English, and they remember you for it. Soon he is inside good old Naya, which is sort of, but not fully, air-conditioned. There is a whole group of girls in identical windbreakers gathered by his baggage carousel, chattering like an exultation of larks under a death-to-drug-traffickers sign. The bags take a long time to arrive. Randy wouldn't have checked baggage at all, except that he acquired a lot of books and a few other souvenirs on his trip, some salvaged from the ruined house and some inherited from his grandfather's trunk. And in Kinakuta he bought some new diving gear that he hopes he will put to use very soon. Finally, he had to buy a big sort of duffel bag on wheels to carry it all. Randy enjoys watching the girls, apparently some kind of high school or college field hockey team on the road. For them, even waiting for the baggage carousel to start up is a big adventure, full of thrills and chills. For example, when the carousel groans into action for a few moments and then shuts down again. But finally it starts up for real, and out comes a whole row of identical gym bags, color-coordinated to match the girls' uniforms, and in the middle of them is Randy's big duffel. He heaves it off the carousel and checks the tiny combination padlocks, one on the zipper for the main compartment, and one on a smaller pocket at the end of the bag. There is one more tiny pocket on the top of the bag which has no practical function that Randy can think of. He didn't use it, and so he didn't lock it. He deploys the bag's telescoping handle, lifts it up onto its built-in wheels, and heads for customs. Along the way, he gets mixed into the group of field hockey players, who find this extremely titillating and hilarious, which is slightly embarrassing for him until they start finding their own hilarity hilarious. There are only a few customs lanes open, and there is a sort of traffic director waving people this way and that. He shoos the girls towards the green lane, and then, inevitably, ducks Randy into a red one. Looking through the lane, Randy can see the area on the other side where people wait to greet arriving passengers. There is a woman in a nice dress there. It's Amy. Randy comes to a complete stop, the better to gape at her. She looks fantastic. He wonders if it's totally presumptuous of him to think that Amy put on a dress for no other reason than that she knew Randy would enjoy looking at her in it. Whether it's presumptuous or not, that's what he does think, and it almost makes him want to faint. He doesn't want to let his mind run completely out of control here, but maybe there is something better in store for him tonight than digging into a bowl of Cap'n Crunch. Randy steps into the lane. He wants to just bolt through and head straight for Amy, but this would be a bad idea. But it's okay. Anticipation never killed anyone. Anticipation can actually be kind of enjoyable. What did Avi say? Sometimes wanting is better than having. Randy's pretty sure that having Amy would not disappoint, but wanting ain't such a bad thing either. He is holding his laptop bag out before him and drawing the big duffel behind, slowing gradually to a stop, so that it won't roll forward under its own momentum and break his knees. There is the requisite long stainless steel table and a bored, fireplug-shaped gentleman behind it saying, "Nationality? Port of embarkation?" for the 100,000th time in his life. Randy hands over his documents and answers the questions while bending down to heft the duffel bag up onto the metal tabletop. "Remove the locks, please," the customs inspector says. Randy bends down and squints at the tiny brass wheels, trying to line them up into the right combination. While he's doing that, he hears the customs inspector working right next to his head, unzipping the tiny empty pockets on the top of the duffel bag. There is a rustling noise. "What is this?" the inspector asks. "Sir? Sir?"
"Yes, what is it?"
Randy says, straightening up and looking the inspector in the eye. Like a model in an infomercial, the inspector holds up a small Ziploc bag right next to his head and points to it with the other hand. A door opens behind him and people come out. The Ziploc bag has been partly filled with sugar or something, maybe confectioner's sugar, and rolled into a cigar-shaped slug.
"What is this, sir?"
the inspector repeats. Randy shrugs. "How should I know? Where did it come from?"
"It came from your bag, sir,"
the inspector says, and points to the little pocket. "No, it didn't. That pocket was empty," Randy says.
"Is this your bag, sir?"
the inspector says, reaching with one hand to look at the paper claim check dangling from its handle. Quite a crowd is gathered behind him, still indistinct to Randy, who is understandably focusing on the inspector.
"I should hope so. I just opened the locks," Randy says.
The inspector turns around and gestures to the people behind him, who, en masse, move forward into the light. They are wearing uniforms, and most of them are carrying guns. Very soon, some of them are behind him. They are, as a matter of fact, surrounding him. Randy looks towards Amy, but sees only a pair of abandoned shoes. She is sprinting barefoot toward a line of pay telephones.
He'll probably never see her in a dress again.
He wonders whether it would be a bad idea, from a narrowly tactical point of view, to ask for a lawyer this soon. The Battle of Manila. Bobby Shafto is awakened by the smell of smoke. It is not the smoke of cookies left too long in the oven, piles of autumn leaves being burned, or Boy Scout campfires. It is a mixture of other kinds of smoke, with which he has become quite familiar in the last couple of years. Tires, fuel, and buildings, for example. He props himself up on one elbow and realizes that he is lying in the bottom of a long, skinny boat. Just above his head, a dirty canvas sail luffs in a treacherous and foul-smelling breeze. It is the middle of the night. He turns his head to look upwind. His head doesn't like it.
fierce pain is trying to batter down the doors of his mind. But the pain is not getting in. He senses the muffled booms of the pain's hobnailed boots against his front door, but that's about it. Ah, someone has given him morphine. Shafto grins appreciatively. Life is good. The world is dark, a matte black hemisphere inverted over the plain of the lake. But there is a horizontal crack around the edge, off to the boat's port side, where yellow light is leaking through. The light glimmers and sparkles like stars viewed through the heat waves above the hood of a black automobile. He sits up, peers at it, gradually getting an idea of scale. The ragged trail of yellow light extends from the boat's 8 o'clock all the way around past the bow to about 1 o'clock. Maybe it is some incredibly weird sunrise phenomenon.
Manila, says a voice behind him.
Huh?
It is Manila,
says another voice, closer to him, speaking the English version of the name.
Why is it all lit up?
Bobby Shafto has not seen a city lit up at night since 1941 and has forgotten what it looks like.
The Japanese have put it to the torch.
The Pearl of the Orient,
someone says, farther back in the boat. And there is rueful laughter. Shafto's head is clearing now. He rubs his eyes and takes a better look. A couple of miles off to port, a steel drum full of fuel takes off into the sky like a rocket and disappears. He begins to make out the bony silhouettes of palm trees along the lake shore, standing out against the flames. The boat moves on across the warm water quietly, tiny waves chiming against its hull. Shafto feels as if he has just been born, a new person coming into a new world. Anyone else would ask why they are traveling into the burning city instead of running away from it. But Shafto doesn't ask, any more than a newborn infant would ask questions. This is the world he has been born into, and he looks at it wide-eyed. The man who has been speaking to him is sitting on a gunwale next to Shafto, a pale face hovering above a black garment, a white rectangular notch in his collar. The light of the burning city refracts warmly in a string of amber beads from which depends a heavy swinging crucifix. Shafto lies back down in the hull of the boat and stares up at him for a while.
They gave me morphine.
I gave you morphine. You were difficult to control.
I apologize, sir,
Shafto says with profound sincerity. He remembers those China Marines who went Asiatic on the trip down from Shanghai, and how they disgraced themselves.
We could not tolerate noise. The Nipponese would have found us.
I understand.
Seeing glory was a very bad shock for you.
Level with me, Padre,
says Bobby Shafto.
My boy, my son, is he a leper too?
The black eyes close, and the pale face moves back and forth in a no.
Glory contracted the disease not long after the child was born, working in a camp in the mountains. The camp was not a very clean place.
Shafto snorts.
No shit, Sherlock.
There is a long, uncomfortable silence. Then the padre says,
I have already taken confessions from the other man. Would you like me to take yours now?
Is that what Catholics do when they're about to die?
They do it all the time. But yes, it is advisable to confess immediately before death. It helps, what is the expression, grease the skids in the afterlife.
Padre, it looks to me like we're only an hour or two away from hitting the beach. If I start confessing my sins to you right now, I might get up to stealing cookies from the cookie jar when I was 8 years old.
The padre laughs. Someone hands Shafto a cigarette already lit. He takes a big suck on it.
We wouldn't have time to get into any of the good stuff, like nailing glory and killing a whole lot of nips and krauts.
Shafto thinks about it for a minute, enjoying the cigarette.
But this is one of those deals where we're all going to die, and it sure looks like one of those deals to me. There is one thing I gotta do. Is this boat going back to Columba?
We hope that the owner can take some women and children back across the lake.
Anyone got a pencil and paper?
Someone passes up a pencil stub, but there is no paper to be found. Shafto searches his pockets and finds nothing but a skein of I Shall Return condoms. He opens one of them, peeling the halves of the wrapper apart carefully and tosses the rubber into the lake. Then he spreads the wrapper out on the top of an ordnance crate and begins to write, I, Robert Shafto, being of sound mind and body, hereby leave all of my worldly goods, including my military death benefits, to my natural-born son, Douglas MacArthur Shafto. He looks up into the burning city. He considers adding something like, if he's still alive, but nobody likes a whiner. So he just signs the fucking thing. The Padre adds his signature as witness. Just to add some extra credibility, Shafto pulls off his dog tags and wraps the will around them, then wraps the dog tags chain around the whole thing. He passes it down to the stern of the boat, where the boatman pockets it and cheerfully agrees to do the right thing with it when he gets back to Columba. The boat isn't wide, but it's very long, and has a dozen hooks crammed onto it. All of them are armed to the teeth with ordnance that has obviously come off an American submarine recently. The weight of men and weaponry keeps the boat so low in the water that waves occasionally splash over the gunwales. Shafto paws through crates in the dark. He can't see for shit, but his hands identify the components of a few Thompson submachine guns down in there.
Bars for weapons,
one of the hucks explains to him.
Don't lose those.
Parts nothing,
Shafto says a few busy seconds later. He produces a fully assembled trench broom from the crate. The red coals of half a dozen I Shall Return cigarettes leap upwards into the hook's mouths as they free their hands for a light round of applause. Someone passes him a pie-shaped magazine, heavy with 45 caliber cartridges.
You know, they invented this kind of ammo just to knock down crazy Filipino bastards,
Shafto announces.
We know,
one of the hooks says.
It's overkill for nips,
Shafto continues, jacking the Tommy gun and the magazine together. The hooks all laugh nastily. One of them is moving up from the stern, making the whole boat rock from side to side. He is a very young, slight fellow. He holds out his hand to Bobby Shafto.
Uncle Robert, do you remember me?
Being called Uncle Robert is hardly the weirdest thing that has happened to Shafto in the last few years, so he lets it slide. He peers at the boy's face, which is dimly illuminated by the combustion of Manila.
You're one of the Altamira boys,
he guesses. The boy salutes him crisply and grins. Then Shafto remembers. 3 years ago, the Altamira family apartment, carrying the freshly impregnated Glory up the stairs as air raid sirens wailed all around the city. An apartment filled with Altamiras. A squad of boys with wooden swords and rifles staring at Bobby Shafto in awe. Shafto throwing them a salute, then running out of the place.
All of us fought the nips, the boy says.
Then his face falls, and he crosses himself.
Two are dead.
Some of you are pretty damn young.
The youngest ones are still in Manila,
the boy says. He and Shafto silently stare across the water into the flames, which have merged into a wall now.
In the apartment? In Malate?
I think so. My name is Fidel.
Is my son in the same place?
I think so. Maybe not.
We'll go find those kids, Fidel.
Half the population of Manila seems to be standing along the water's edge or in the water, waiting for a boat like theirs to show up. MacArthur is coming down from the north, and the Nipponese Air Force troops are coming up from the south, so the isthmus between Manila Bay and Laguna Dabai is corked at both ends by great military forces waging total war. A ragged Dunkirk-style evacuation is in progress along the lakeside of the isthmus, but the number of boats is not adequate. Some of the refugees are behaving like civilized human beings, but others are wading and swimming out towards them, trying to get first dibs. A wet hand reaches up out of the water and grabs the boat's gunwale, until Shafto crushes it with the butt of his trench broom. The swimmer falls away, clutching his hand and screaming, and Shafto tells him he's ugly. There is about half an hour's more ugliness as the boat cruises back and forth, just out of swimming range, and the padre handpicks an assortment of women carrying small children. They are pulled up into the boat one by one, and the hooks climb off the boat one by one, and when it's all finished, the boat turns around and glides off into the darkness. Shafto and the hooks wade ashore, carrying crates of ammunition between them. By this point, Shafto has grenades dangling off his body all over the place, like teats on a pregnant sow, and most of the hooks are walking all slow and stiff-legged, trying not to collapse under the weight of the bandoliers in which they have practically mummified themselves. They stagger into the city, bucking a tide of smoky refugees. This lowland along the shore of the lake is not the city proper. It is a suburb of humble buildings made in the traditional style, of woven rattan screens with thatched roofs. They burn effortlessly, throwing up the red sheets of flame that they watched from the boat. Inland, and a few miles north, is the city proper, with many masonry buildings. The Nipponese have put it to the torch also, but it burns sporadically as isolated towers of flame and smoke. Shafto and his band had been expecting to hit the beach like Marines and get mowed down at the water's edge. Instead, they march for a good mile and a half inland before they actually lay eyes on the enemy. Shafto's actually glad to see some real nips. He's been getting nervous because the lack of opposition has made the hooks giddy and overconfident. Then half a dozen Nip Air Force troops spill out of a store which they have evidently been looting. They are all carrying liquor bottles and stop on the sidewalk to set fire to the place, fashioning Molotov cocktails from stolen bottles of fire water. Shafto pulls the pin on a grenade and underhands it down the sidewalk, watches it skitter for a while, and then ducks into a doorway. When he hears the explosion and sees shrapnel crack the windshield of a car parked along the street, he jumps out onto the sidewalk, ready to open up with the Tommy gun. But it's not necessary. All of the Nips are down, thrashing weakly in the gutter. Shafto and the other hooks all take cover and wait for more Nipponese troops to arrive and help their injured comrades. But it doesn't happen. The hooks are elated. Shafto stands in the street brooding while the padre administers last rites to the dead and dying Nipponese. Obviously, discipline has completely broken down. The Nips know they are trapped. They know MacArthur is about to run right over them like a lawnmower plowing through an anthill. They have become a mob. For Shafto, it's going to be easier to fight mobs of drunken, deranged looters, but there's no telling what they might be doing to civilians farther north.
"We're wasting our fucking time," Shafto says. "Let's get to Malate and avoid further engagements."
"You are not in command of this group," says one of the others.
"I am."
"Who's that?"
Shafto asks, squinting against the light of the burning liquor store. It turns out to be a Phil-American lieutenant, who was sitting way back in the boat and who has been of no use at all to this point. Shafto knows in his bones that this guy is not going to be a good combat leader. He inhales deeply, trying to heave a sigh, then gags on smoke instead.
"Sir? Yes, sir,"
he says, and salutes.
"I am Lieutenant Morales, and if you have any more suggestions, bring them to me or keep them to yourself."
"Sir, yes, sir,"
Shafto says. He doesn't bother to memorize the lieutenant's name. They work their way north through narrow, clogged streets for a couple of hours. The sun comes up. A small airplane flies over the city, drawing ragged fire from exhausted, drunken Nipponese troops.
"It is a P-51 Mustang,"
Lieutenant Morales exclaims.
"It's a fucking Piper Cub, goddammit,"
Shafto says. He has been holding his tongue to this point, but he can't help it now.
"It's an artillery spotter plane."
"Then why is it flying over Manila?"
Lieutenant Morales asks smugly. He enjoys this rhetorical triumph for about 30 seconds. Then the first artillery rounds begin to bore in from the north and blast the shit out of various buildings. They get into their first serious firefight about half an hour later against a platoon of Nipponese Air Force troops holed up in a stone bank at the V formed by a couple of intersecting avenues. Lieutenant Morales comes up with an extremely complicated plan that involves breaking up into three smaller groups. Morales takes three men forward into the cover of a large fountain that sits in the middle of the square. There, they are immediately trapped by heavy fire from the Nipponese. They squat and huddle behind the shelter of the fountain for about a quarter of an hour, at which point an artillery shell glides in from the north, a black pellet easing downwards in a flawless parabolic trajectory, and scores a direct hit on the fountain. It turns out to be a high-explosive shell, which does not blow up until it hits something, the fountain in this case. The Padre gives Lieutenant Morales and his men last rites from a safe distance of 100 yards or so, which is as good a place as any, since there is nothing left of their physical bodies. Bobby Shafto is voted new squad leader by acclamation. He leads them around the square, giving the whole intersection a wide berth. Way up north somewhere, one of the general's batteries is doggedly trying to zero in on that fucking bank, blowing up half the neighborhood in the process. A Piper Cub banks overhead doing lazy figure eights, offering suggestions over the radio. Almost there. Yeah, a little to the left. Nope, too far. Now bring it in a little bit. It takes Shafto's group a whole day to make another mile's progress towards Malate. They could get there in no time by simply running up the middle of major streets, but the artillery fire is coming in heavier and heavier as they head north. Worse, much of it consists of anti-personnel rounds with radar proximity fuses that blow up while they're still several yards above the ground, the better to spray shrapnel all over the place. The airbursts look like the splayed foliage of burned coconut palms. Shafto sees no point in getting them all killed, so they take it a block at a time, sprinting one by one from doorway to doorway, and scouting the buildings with great care in case there are any nips lying in wait to shoot at them from the windows. When that happens, they have to hunker down, scout the place out, count windows and doors, make guesses about the building's floor plan, send men out to check various lines of sight. Usually, it's not really difficult to root the nips out of these buildings, but it is time-consuming. They hole up in a half-burned apartment building around sunset, and take turns getting a couple of hours' sleep. Then they push on through the night, when the artillery fire is less intense. Bobby Shafto gets the whole remaining squad, 9 men including the Padre, into Malate at about 4 in the morning. By the time dawn breaks, they have reached the street where the Altamiras live, or lived. They arrive just in time to see the entire apartment block being systematically blasted into rubble by round after high-explosive round. No one runs out of it. No cries or screams can be heard in between the explosions. The place is empty. They break down the barricaded door of a drugstore across the street and have a chat with the sole living occupants, a 75-year-old woman and a 6-year-old boy. The Nipponese came through the neighborhood a couple of days ago, she says, heading north, in the direction of Intramuros. They herded the women and children out of the buildings and marched them in one direction. They pulled out all of the men and the boys over a certain age and marched them off in another. She and her grandson escaped by hiding in a cupboard. Shafto and his squad emerge from the drugstore onto the street, leaving the Padre behind to grease some heavenly skids. 15 seconds later, 2 of them are killed by shrapnel from an anti-personnel round that detonates above the street nearby. The remainder of the squad backs right into a group of marauding Nipponese stragglers coming around the corner, and a completely insane close-quarters firefight ensues. They have the Nips heavily outgunned, but half of Shafto's men are too stunned to fight. They are accustomed to the jungle. Some of them have never been to the city before, even in peacetime, and they just stand there gaping. Shafto ducks into a doorway and begins to make a fantastic amount of noise with his trench broom. The Nips start throwing grenades around like firecrackers, doing as much damage to themselves as to the hooks. The engagement is ridiculously confused, and doesn't really end until another artillery round comes in, kills several of the Nips, and leaves the rest so stunned that Shafto is able to walk out in the open and dispatch them with shots from his Colt. They drag 2 of their wounded into the drugstore and leave them there. 1 other man is dead. They are down to 5 fighting men and 1 increasingly busy Padre. Their firefight has brought down another barrage of anti-personnel artillery, and so the best they can do for the rest of the day is find a basement to hide in and try to get some sleep. Shafto sleeps hardly at all, and so when night falls, he takes a couple of Benzedrine tablets, shoots a bit of morphine to take the edge off, and leads his squad out into the streets. The next neighborhood to the north is called Ermita. It has a lot of hotels. After Ermita is Rizal Park. The walls of Intramuros rise up from Rizal Park's northern edge. After Intramuros is the Pasig River, and MacArthur's on the far side of the Pasig. So if Shafto's son and the rest of the Altamirers are still alive, they have to be somewhere in the couple of miles between here and Fort Santiago on the near bank of the Pasig. Shortly after they cross into the neighborhood of Ermita, they happen upon a stream of blood trickling out of a doorway across the sidewalk into the gutter. They kick down the door of the building and discover that its ground floor is filled with corpses of Filipino men, several dozen in all. All of them have been bayoneted. One is still alive. Shafto and the Hooks carry him out onto the sidewalk and begin looking for some place to put him while the Padre circulates through the building, touching each corpse briefly and muttering something in Latin. When he comes out, he is bloody up to the knees.
Any women? Children?
Shafto asks him. The Padre shakes his head no. They are only a few blocks from the Philippine General Hospital, so they carry the wounded man in that direction. Coming around the corner, they see that the hospital's buildings have been half-destroyed by MacArthur's artillery, and the grounds are covered with human beings laid out on sheets. Then they realize that the men circulating around the area carrying rifles are Nipponese troops. A couple of shots are fired in their direction. They have to duck into an alley and set the wounded man down. A few moments later, a trio of Nipponese soldiers appears in hot pursuit. Shafto has had enough time to think this one through, so he lets them get a good few paces into the alley. Then he and the Hooks kill them silently with blades. By the time reinforcements have been sent out after them, Shafto and his men have disappeared into the alleyways of Ermita, which in many places are running red with the blood of slaughtered Filipino men and boys.